Good morning, everyone. My name is Ben Riga. We're going to get started on time because I have a lot of content, maybe too much content. So I want to give myself as much time as possible to get through it. Can you put my slides up? Oh, I guess I just pushed a button. Excellent. That works much better. As I said, my name is Ben Riga. The first note I should make is my email address is on the screen. Please feel free to take a note of it if you want to ask me questions later. Maybe you're too shy to ask in the room, or maybe you remember a question tomorrow or next week. Feel free to email me. My Twitter handle is there as well. I'm not making any threats, but if you don't follow me on Twitter, I will shoot the puppy. So anyway, it's at Ben Riga. Please follow me on Twitter. It makes me feel good when people follow me. So here's the topics we're going to cover today. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about launchers and choosers, and I'll explain the differences and go through some of the basics. We're not going to go through every individual launcher and chooser. They all sort of behave the same. So hopefully you will be able to gather what you need from those. We'll spend a lot of time talking about the camera, because the camera, you can use it via a chooser, or you now have full access to the camera stream in Mango in the latest release, and so I wanted to spend a lot of time talking about that. We'll talk about video and so on. We'll briefly touch on microphones, sensors, and video content, but unfortunately there's just not enough time in the 75 minutes or so that we have today to go into detail in all of those. So if you have questions, please ask me, or again, if you want to ask me later or by email, what have you, more than happy to do that. So let's jump in. I'm going to start first with a new topic that's available, or a new feature rather, that's available in Windows Phone 7.5, and that is access to the contacts and the calendar. You were always able to retrieve individual contacts. So for instance, if you had to go and send someone an email and so on, you were able to do that by using the choose user. But now you have full access to contacts and the calendar databases. And so let's talk about that. The first thing is that there are some obligations that you as a developer have to take on if you want to have access to the contact and calendars on behalf of the end user. Basically, you have to ask permission, and you have to be very clear about what you're going to do with those contacts and calendars entries. Because you have access to some information that is very sensitive, particular end users will get very upset if you abuse that privilege. And we've seen episodes or cases of that happen recently. For instance, Instagram on the iOS platform was caught up showing that they were actually taking people's contact databases and uploading it to their server for what was probably legitimate reasons, but because they weren't disclosing it in a very clear way to end users, they were sort of caught in this controversy. And so, again, make it very clear what you're doing with your application and what you're doing with contacts and calendars so that the end users always feels comfortable using your application. You have to if you're going to take advantage of contacts and calendars, you have to request those capabilities. And so there are capabilities in the manifest that you have to declare. And that is verified when you go into production. We'll do that as part of certification. There are a number of different providers. So if you think of contacts, for instance, if for those of you that, how many people are not using a Windows phone right now? Oh, wow, a lot. Okay, so let's talk about that. So in Windows Phone, when you set up your Windows Phone, you basically tell Windows Phone what different accounts you have across the internet. So for instance, you might have 1 or 2 or 10 different email accounts. You may have a Facebook account. You may have a Twitter account. You may have a Windows Live account. LinkedIn, and all sorts of accounts across the internet. Basically, the Windows Phone operating system will actually aggregate all of the contacts across all of your accounts and make them available in one place, which we call, for the end user, it's called the People Hub. And so as a developer, you want access to all of those contacts. And so we make them available, and we aggregate them for you. And there are certain capabilities that you have and certain rights and privileges that we as Microsoft have the ability to give you. Some things we can give you, some things we can't give you, based not so much on technical abilities, but more on licensing and privacy rights and so on. So these are the various contacts that you have available to you. So for instance, on the Windows Phone device, so for instance, if you have a device and you enter someone's contact information on the device as an end user, of course you have full access to that. If you are using Windows Live Hotmail, because Windows Live Hotmail is our own service, we give you full access to that. Exchange accounts, again, you have full access to the local addresses, not to stuff that's in the global address list, but only stuff that's local on the device, stuff that's been pulled down. You may have a mobile operator address book that's been pulled in. Or you may have a Facebook account. Now, Facebook has only given us the right to give you the contact name and the contact picture. You don't have access to things like email addresses and all of that stuff, but you do have access to some information from Facebook. And then there's other things that are aggregated. So, for instance, Twitter, LinkedIn, all of that stuff, you just don't have access to that. We don't have the right to give it to you, so unfortunately you won't have access to it. So how do you read contacts? It's pretty straightforward. You basically new up a contacts object and then tell it where you want your... You give it an event handler for when the search is complete, and then you fire a search, and then once it's complete, it hands it off to that event handler. And then the event handler can do pretty much whatever it wants. In this case, it's binding it to a list box that's on the screen. And I'll show you how that works in a couple of seconds. But it's pretty straightforward. It comes back in a list. You can bind it, and it just works, which is kind of nice. This is the XAML code for the binding and so on. You can also do very specific searches. And so, in this case, this is the data sources. So remember I talked about the various different types of data sources that are available within the contacts database. This would be how you would retrieve what accounts the end user's device has access to. And so in this case, I could actually iterate through and say, oh, this one has a local phone book, it has a Facebook account, it has Hotmail, and so on, and you would have access to all of those. And those are iterated. There is a storage kind, storage kind, which you can use the enumeration for that to get access to all the various account types that we talked about earlier. So let me show you an example. Yes. I should have mentioned this earlier. If you do have questions, please raise your hand and shout them out. It's going to be hard. There's no microphone. So if you're, I think I see some people way in the back. So hopefully you'll be able to shout very loud, and we'll try and get your questions answered. Yes, sorry.
Could it be that you just switched your sessions? Because really this was about gaming.
Ah, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, so I apologize. How many people are here for the gaming session? Okay, so Rob Miles' plane flight got canceled, and so he was not able to make it at this time, and so he and I switched sessions. My session was supposed to be later this evening, or early or late afternoon, and so we've swapped. And so Rob, I heard he's now at the airport making his way, probably running through the airport right now, and he'll be here soon, but his session is late in the afternoon. I think it's 4:15, something like that, last session of the day. Sorry about that. I should have mentioned that earlier. Okay. Any other questions? How am I doing? Is this interesting? Am I going too fast or too slow? I hope I'm not going too fast. I know I think I actually prepared too much content, so I want to try and get through as much as possible. Okay, so let's actually have a look at a demo. So this actually, let me just run it, and then we can look at the code, although we have actually seen the code at this point. So this is an app that basically just pulls contact information and the sources. I've run it, and you see that this is actually running on the emulator. This stuff is really interesting, you know. All right, it's your loss. So here it's pulling information from the contact database on the phone, and in this case I'm using the emulator. You'll notice that I'm using the emulator, and there are actually contacts in the emulator. When you get the emulator, there are some sample. There's, I think, 10 or so, or what is it, 8 or so contacts that are in the emulator so that you can actually use those as samples. And in this case, you'll see at the top, the sources are phone. That source basically just means that there are contacts that have been entered on the phone. And so if I had added a Facebook account, for instance, you would see that, and then you would see all the contacts for Facebook and so on. If we have a look at this, it's actually pretty straightforward. Let me see here. So there's the search completed. Here's the load button. And so you'll see that I'm just setting some text on the screen saying loading. You don't actually see it because it's so fast. Then I'm newing up a contacts variable that I'm going to use, and then setting the context for it, then setting my event handler for when the search is actually complete, and then firing off that search. And in this case, I'm not doing any filtering at all. We'll talk about filtering in a couple of minutes. And I'm telling it, giving it an object so I can track that. And then once the search is complete, it comes back and basically tries to bind the results to the result, the list box on the screen. And then it does the same thing for the accounts as well. Any questions on that? Can you guys see this in the back, or is my text big enough? Shout yes or no? Perfect, thank you. Okay, so any questions? Okay, so that's pretty straightforward stuff, I think. So let's actually take it a little bit farther. As I said, you can actually filter results. In this case, we might want to filter the results and show, in this case, it's RO, and so it's going to find all of the names that begin with RO, and there's a couple in the database actually that do that. And so you can use the filter kind to change the different types of filters that you can do. In this case, I'm using the display name, and so it would filter on that. You can also use pin to start. So that means you would get a list of all of the contacts that the end user has pinned to their start screen, which would be an indication that they're kind of important to them. You can filter on email addresses. So for whatever reason, you want to find a particular email address or on phone number. So basically, ability to do that. Those are the four simple ones. If you need to do something a little bit more advanced, you would use a link query. I do caution you that if you use a link query, that they can be slow. So you would have to make sure that, especially if an end user has, like in my case, where I've combined, you know, hundreds of LinkedIn accounts, hundreds of Facebook friends and Twitter friends and so on, your contact database tends to be very, very long. And so it can be slow to return. You can do the very, very same thing with appointments. We're not going to do it here, but it works almost exactly the same way. You would do an async search, and the result sets come back, and when the search is completed, you get access to that. I'm actually going to cough, so can I turn my mic off for a second? Is that... Okay, good. I didn't cough in your ears or anything, did I? So anyway, it works exactly the same way as what we just saw with contacts. I'm not going to actually show you a demo, but if you can do it for contacts, you can do it for appointments. The one thing I will tell you is that the contact database, as I mentioned earlier, does have 7 or 8 sample contacts. There is no sample calendar information on the emulator, and so unfortunately you have to do a lot of your testing on a device. Any questions on that? I can't see all of you, so you'll have to shout if I don't see you. So there we were talking about actually pulling information out of the contact database and doing something with it. Now we'll talk about how you can actually create a contact. And here now we're starting to talk about what we refer to as launchers and choosers. So an application cannot create a contact without the user being aware. And this is something where we're very clear on this. There's nothing that can happen in the device where the user just doesn't know. The user is king. They have full access. They should be always aware of what you're doing. And so if you need to create a contact, you would use what's called a chooser. A chooser will actually launch a screen, and the end user will see what you're about to create, can make changes to it, and then has the option to either save or cancel. There's no way that you can actually create contacts in bulk behind the scenes. It's just not something, capability that works. And it works very similarly to some of the other things that you may have seen. It's all async. It happens. And the other thing, how many of you were in my fast app switching and tombstoning session that I did yesterday? So you guys learned some good concepts there, because anytime you use a launcher or chooser, your application gets becomes dormant and could possibly get tombstoned. And so you have to make sure that if you're using launchers and choosers, in general, you should be taking advantage of fast app switching anyway. But launchers and choosers kind of forces you to do that. So there's a difference between a launcher and a chooser, and it's fairly easy to understand. Basically, a chooser is a capability that we give you as a developer where it would launch some capability, the end user would do some activity, and then it would automatically come back to your application and hand you a result back. If they have chosen something, they may give you a whatever the end user has chosen, or in some cases, it's just the result back saying that the, for instance, when I'm creating a contact, it just gives me a result back that says the user has created the contact or has not created the contact or has canceled or what have you, or the contact was not able to be created. So that's one way to do that. A launcher is very similar and works in a very similar way. The difference is that the launcher will not automatically come back to your application. It's up to the end user to hit the back button and come back to your application. So things like launching the web browser or doing pretty much any one of a number of different things. And I'll actually show you some of the choosers and launchers that are available to you. But like I said, it's kind of an important concept to understand the difference between a launcher and a chooser. So let's talk about choosers, and we'll use a chooser, as I said, to create a contact. In this case, this is a chooser where we'll enter some information, a first name and last name, and then we'll hand it to the chooser, and the chooser will then show it to the end user. The end user can accept or decline to save that. So the way it works is pretty similar. You new up your... actually, the first thing that's important here is that when you declare your chooser, you'll notice that the scope is actually on the scope of the page. And that's kind of important because you need to be able to have access to it when you come back. And so it's important that you declare it at the page level. And then when you create your... when you new it up and initialize it, you need to do that in the constructor of the page. And then in this case, we're using the click method for a button to actually send that information to the chooser. So that show method is what you would use, and that's common across all of the choosers. You show, and then you would have an event handler that would tell you when the end user has done their duty or done the task and is coming back, and so you can actually do things with it. Here is the chooser completion. So this is the event handler that I just mentioned. In this case, we're just checking the result that says that it came back okay, and then so you can display a message or you can do other sorts of things. You should keep in mind when you're saving a contact, for instance, you hand the information to the chooser shows it to the end user. The end user can actually make changes to that information. And so even though you may have built all of the information into a contact and handed it to the end user can make changes and then save. So don't make an assumption that what you're handing the chooser is what has actually been saved. You actually, if that's important to the scenario that you're building, you should then go and reload and make sure that what got saved is what you expected to get saved. I talked about application switching yesterday, but when a chooser runs, you're basically getting pushed dormant. You get the deactivated method. You become dormant, and if the end user doesn't come back and does all sorts of other tasks, goes and plays games, takes a phone call, sends a text message, at some point, if there's not enough memory or if there's too many tasks running or that are dormant, you may get tombstoned. And so you need to be able to handle that in place. And if you didn't attend my session, it's been recorded, and if you have questions about that, I'm more than happy to help with that. So let's actually look at what it takes to create a contact. So this is very similar to the example we just saw a minute ago. So let's just run it. And this time I can load the contacts. And that worked pretty much the same way that it did before. But now I can actually say, let me add myself. Whoops, page up. That's a tip, by the way, if you're running on the emulator, if you hit the page up button, you can actually use the keyboard on your machine, which is much easier than actually trying to type by actually tapping on the keyboard on the SIP. So there I've typed in two edit controls, and we're going to grab those edit controls and use that to populate some text, and then we'll hand that to the chooser. When I click the make contact, my application has now been pushed into the background. It's now dormant. And now it's launched a chooser. This is the create user chooser. And so you can see here that the name is available. I can actually click on that and say, add something to it. And if I click save, it comes back to my chooser. Now I have information. And the end user has the capability to edit and or change any of these features, just like they would on a normal as they're using their application. And then if I save, it comes back. So there's that message. Just normally you probably wouldn't do something like this, but in this case it's just showing that the application has done. You can see the resuming with the buttons in the things in the background. Can you see that, by the way? Yeah. And so if I click OK, you'll see that we've now come back. It's not in there, but if I reload, I should see that now there is a Ben Riga contact. Any questions on that? Let's have a look at the actual code, actually. It's pretty straightforward. That load button does all of the same things that we talked about earlier. So I'm not going to spend any time there. It's identical to the one we saw earlier. Here I'm pulling from the edit control. I've set up an event handler, and then I know what happens when it comes back. It really is as simple as that. So all of the work is done for you by the chooser of saving that to the contact database. Yes?
Could it be that you get tombstones while you're in the contacts page?
So the question was, is it possible that you get tombstoned while you're in the contact page? It's not likely that you would get tombstoned that early. It is possible, actually, but it's not likely. But the end user could do many things, right? They have full control over what's going on. So the end user, you could click that make contact. The end user is now in the create a contact chooser. They could then hit the start button and go and play a game. Or they could get a phone call. They could get a toast that goes across that says they just got a text message. They click on that and go and reply to the text message. You can do all sorts of things, and you have no control over that. That's why it's completely asynchronous. And then at some point, if there's not enough memory, your application will get tombstoned. Or if it goes over 5 applications in the background, your application will get tombstoned.
And in that case, you never go into the event handler.
Sorry, say that again?
If you get tombstoned,
yep.
You never come in the event handler of the
company. So the question was, does that mean that if I get tombstoned, that my application won't see the event handler?
Yeah.
And that's not the case. You will still see the event handler. Because when you get tombstoned, you'll resume back again. And when you resume back again, then it will trigger that event. Were you in my session yesterday?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so tombstoning, you don't lose any access. You still get all of the same events get triggered. You do have to be careful about saving your contacts and all of that stuff. But things like event handlers and stuff, you won't lose any of those. You'll still get access to all of that. You look a little confused, so if you want to chat about it later, please come see me. Any other questions? Is this good? Interesting? Too slow? Too fast? You guys asleep? Okay. Too much chocolate from Valentine's Day? Let's see. Did we? I think we went through this, right? It's pretty straightforward stuff. So there's other types of save tasks, and these are all all behave pretty much the same way. You have save an email address, and basically, so this would allow you to save a contact using an email address, or to take an email address and add it to an existing contact, or the end user would choose that. Same thing with a phone number, or save a ringtone. So if you have a particular sound, for instance, as part of your application, you may want to allow the end user to save a sound file to their ringtone database and then hook that up to their accounts. There is no saver to create an appointment. There's no way for you to actually create an appointment in the appointment database, in the calendar. These are all of the choosers that you have access to, including some of the ones that we've already done, and we'll see a few more of these. I'll show you the camera one, for instance. Some of them are there, but you can't really use them. The one in particular is the game invite task. This is a task that would allow, if you're building a game, for instance, to have a multi-user game. Unfortunately, it's really only available to a small select number of publishers that are allowed to publish Xbox Live games. So hopefully that changes over time, but right now that's kind of the way it works. And then there's some launchers. Remember the difference I said earlier, choosers are tasks. So in this case, you can understand where these choosers all do stuff for your application, and then they come back and give you a result in some way. Whereas a launcher, you know, a web browser task basically launches something, the end user can do whatever they want, and then hopefully they remember to hit the back button to come back. And then there's all sorts of launchers. Some of them are kind of handy. So for instance, the marketplace review task is something you should always put in every one of your applications. You should always encourage your end users to go and review your application. And the way you do that is by asking them explicitly, or by making it available as part of your menuing, where you could say, hey, please, if you've used the application, click the review, and it will actually open up the marketplace and take them right into the review and allow them to do a review and then come back. It's kind of a handy thing. Things, email compose task, SMS compose task, all of those things are work in that kind of fashion. The rest of the session, we're going to talk about using the camera. I'll start by using the camera. There's really two ways to use the camera. The way that you could in Windows Phone 7.0 was to launch the camera capture task, and then it would come back with a photo or an image, rather. And that was handy, but it limited the scenarios that you could do. In Windows Phone 7.5, you now have the ability to do lots of other stuff. Basically, we've given you access to this camera stream, whatever images are coming in through the camera. And that means you can do all sorts of wild and crazy things like augmented reality applications or barcode scanning, all of that cool stuff. So let's start with just capturing a photo. It works very similar to the chooser that we did earlier. So in this case, it's going to launch the camera. You see here I'm newing up a camera task, I'm setting the event handler, and then I'm showing that task. In that case, it's really going to look to the end user as if they are using the standard camera task, the same way as if they had pushed the camera button. And then it will return with an image, and you can do whatever you want with that image. Using the emulator, it basically comes back with a white block with some crazy things. It's not really handy as a camera, the emulator. And so whenever I'm using camera, I always use my device. It's just a lot more easy. But you can use the emulator to do very simple testing and so on. When it's complete, it works very similar to the one that we saw earlier. You can do pretty much what you need to. In this case, we're newing up a bitmap image from the file name that the camera task has given back to us, and then using that to set it as the source for a photo image that we have on screen. But you could do anything you wanted to with that. Let's actually run this. Actually, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to run it on my device. Okay, let's try that again. Okay, I think my... I'm actually using USB out, which is a capability that we have within Microsoft. Unfortunately, it's not made available to, for a number of legal reasons, we can't make it available to you as a developer. Okay, let's see if that works. Okay, maybe I won't show you the... There we go. Okay, so we're getting a lot of flicker. So I think everyone saw my password there. Don't tell anyone. So let me just show you the app. So there's just a camera shot. And so it's basically on the, when I take a photo, when I click that button, take photo, it's now launched the chooser. You can't see that. Let's try that again. Oh, wow. This is crazy. Okay. Apologize for this. Let's try this one more time, and if that doesn't work, we'll just use the emulator. And it does not look like it wants to work. Okay. All right. Let's forget about using that, and we'll just use the emulator. Okay. So the emulator, here we go. And so in this case, you may have seen this, when I click the take a photo, it's actually launching the photo chooser. You can't see it because it just doesn't work that way. But what's going on, actually you should be able to see that. And when I, there we go. So this is what you see when you're using the emulator to take a photo. This is kind of a random image that's being generated for you just to show you that there's something going on in the viewfinder. And then at some point, this is the equivalent of clicking the camera button. And so I've now taken the photo. And this is what the end user would do, is either click the button or click on the screen. And then they can either accept or retake that photo. And then when I accept, it's actually giving me that image. This is the generic image that you get back. And then you can do anything you want. In this case, we're just displaying it on the screen. Let's just have a quick look at the code for that. Here we see the... we're looking at the wrong... there it is, camera task. And so... I'm newing up a camera capture task, wiring up the event handler, and then just showing using the dot show method. And then the end user does all of the work of actually taking the photo. And then at some point they come back and we wire it up to the photo image, which is the photo image, the image control that we have on in the XAML. Any questions on that? This is pretty much the way it worked in Windows Phone 7.0, so it hasn't changed. You may have a few extra options, but I don't think it's actually changed much since Windows Phone 7.0. So let's have a look at some of the things that you now have the capability to do with having access to the camera stream. And in-application capture is sort of a generic way to take advantage of that. And basically what it does is it gives you access to the stream, and then you can do pretty much anything you want with that stream. Normally you would display it to the end user, but that's not really necessary. It's up to the whatever scenario you're building. And you would use a video brush, for instance, to demonstrate what's going on to the end user. Here's how you would wire that up. So you define a photo camera object, and you new that up, and then you set the video brush source to the camera. In this case, there's just a rectangle on the screen, and we've set the video brush to that rectangle and just paint on the screen. And at some point, we're going to allow the end user to capture an image. And when that captured image is ready, we need to know that. And so we're wiring up an event handler that tells us when that is available. And this is the, like I said, this is just a simple rectangle. In this case, it's a 320 by 240. And then we're defining a video brush in the fill there. And this is, like I said, we're giving the end user the capability to actually take a photo. And we need to do that somehow, either by having a button or managing a gesture or what have you. In this case, basically, we're just using the capture image method to do that. And you have access to various options there, things like turning the flash on and off and so on. There are properties there that you can play with. And then when the capture image process is done, in other words, your image is actually ready, it will come back and show you that image. So here it does that using a begin invoke, and we're doing, in this case, we're just saving the image. There's a number of things you can do with an image. You can display it on the screen. You can save it to your local storage, to isolated storage, storage of the application. Or in this case, we're using the media library to actually save it to the end user's camera roll for whatever reason. And you have the capability of do that depending on what scenario you want or what capabilities you want to surface to the end user. And they all work pretty much the same way. As soon as the capture image available is ready, then you can have access to that image. In this case, the image stream there. Here we're displaying the image on screen by just setting the picture image source to the bitmap image of the image that has come back. And then this is, again, same idea, except now we're saving it to isolated storage. Any questions on that? Let's actually have a look at how that would work. Let me load the demo. So it's kind of very similar to the way it worked earlier with the capture image, but now it's up to us to define what the viewfinder looks like and giving the end user the full capabilities of what we want to do there. And so here, this is actually a landscape application, so let me just flip the emulator over. And so we're taking that video stream, and we're using the video brush to pour that into a rectangle on the screen. And then, as I said, the emulator is actually generating an image for us. It's just a random box that goes around that rectangle there. And then we also have here another image control. And when I click the take picture, it will take the picture, and then it will just give me that random image that I can use there. But that's pretty much the way it works. And so you could do similar types of things. This is kind of... well, we'll do something with that information in a second, but let me just show you how this works. And as I said, there's different things that you can do with this. So we're on the unnavigated two. I'm creating a new photo camera, setting the source for that viewfinder brush in that rectangle, and then setting up the event handler. And then the event handler, we'll come back to that. And then there's the photo button click. So as soon as I click that capture image, some stuff happens. And then I would basically grab whatever I needed to do with that. So I can save to the media library, load the image picture back into our image control, and I could save the image into isolated storage. Any questions? You guys are really quiet. You know, the fast app switching guys, they were asking lots of questions. Okay. Not even laughing at my jokes. Okay, let's continue along. How am I doing on time? I have till noon, right? So I think we're good. So what we've done in this case is we pretty much built that camera. We did the first one where we used the chooser, and we grabbed the photo and displayed it or saved it, what have you. And then we built the same thing using the camera stream. You normally wouldn't do that because you don't need to do that. If all you're doing is taking a photo, then you use the chooser. On the other hand, if you need to do something with that data, whatever kind of information, for instance, if you're building an augmented reality app, you would want to do some processing on that stream that's coming back. And so the next example is going to show you one example of that. And in this case, we're going to build, this is actually a demo from Rob Miles. It's what he calls the funky camera, where we're just going to do some crazy stuff with the color on that camera. And let me reboot my camera while we're doing that. And if we can try that again, we'll see if we can get the camera to work. So again, there's all sorts of scenarios depending on what you have to do with whatever your application is doing. It's really up to your own creativity of what you might want to do with that image data. In this case, we're just going to do some crazy stuff on the color that's coming back. So we're going to scan through every single pixel on the image that comes back, and we're going to do some bit shifting using, you know, just some just crazy stuff. And this is going to separate out the primaries, and it's just going to make the image look a little bit crazy. In this case, this is the formula that we're going to use, and we're going to call this formula, sorry, this function, on every single pixel on every image that comes back in the stream. This is how we would start the camera, pretty much the same way we saw earlier. We're going to create a new writable bitmap and then set the source to that writable bitmap, and then we're going to have the event handler for when the camera is initialized. So earlier we were doing a capture image, which is handy if all you're doing is capturing photos. In this case, we actually want to do stuff with the image, or sorry, with the buffer of that camera control. And so we're going to do that when the camera is initialized. So we're starting the camera, and then when it's initialized, we want to know that because we're going to kind of hook in and do some crazy stuff there. When the camera's initialized, we're going to start a thread, and we're going to pump those frames coming out of the buffer to that thread that's running off the UI thread, and it will run alongside the application and do some crazy stuff with that buffer and then feed that back. And so this is what is going to happen. So it's going to grab the preview buffer from the camera, do all the thread syncing and all that stuff, and then grab the preview buffer, and then for every single pixel on the image, it's going to call that funky color function that we defined earlier and do some bit switching and bit fiddling on there. And then once it's done, it's going to write that to the screen so you can see this crazy image. So let me see. Let me try one more time with my... with my camera, because it's a little easier to understand what's going on. Seems to be a lot better this time. Okay, so let's do funky camera. And so here you see where I have my viewfinder on the left. Can you see that? Yeah. And so I'm just, you'll notice the speed is actually pretty good. So it's staying pretty close. There's a little bit of a lag. But if you think about it, we're actually scanning the image, and then actually for every single one of the bits or pixels in that image, we're scanning and doing some crazy do some crazy stuff here, right? So let's have a look at that. I think we saw some of that. Let me just load up that. And by the way, if you're interested in any of these demos, please drop me an email. I'm more than happy to share the code. And the slides I think we're going to share anyway, so you can get those from the conference website, I assume. I've already given it to to them. And so let's come back to where we were. So here's that, in this case, color to gray. Here's that bit shifting that it's doing there, right? And... sorry, funky color, there it is there. And then here's where it's newing up the photo camera, creating the writable bitmap, hooking up the event handler, and then setting the source for the viewfinder brush. This is something we did earlier. It's pretty straightforward. And then once the camera's initialized, that's when we hook in and we start doing some crazy stuff, basically using the thread. And let me just pop that back up. And here's where we're doing that, where we're pumping that those frames directly to that funky color. And then once it comes back, we write that pixel onto the screen. Pretty straightforward. I mean, don't worry about the math and so on for the image processing, but it's pretty straightforward. And you can do the same sort of thing with your own application. So for instance, if you were writing a barcode scanner, you could be scanning the barcode and then looking at that image, looking for a barcode to see if there's a valid barcode, and then processing that without having to wait for the end user to click and so on. Or if you had an augmented reality application, you might be doing things like popping images on or text on the screen based on the compass location and the rotation and all of that cool stuff. Any other or any questions? Am I just doing such a great job that you're getting it? Or I don't see anyone sleeping, so it can't be that. Using the microphone, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on there. It's very straightforward. There's a really good example on MSDN if you need access to the microphone. You can get really good access with almost no latency. A little bit of latency, but you get almost a real-time access to the microphone. It uses some of the XNA framework to do that, but you don't have to write in XNA. You can get that using Silverlight or XNA if you prefer. But generally, you have access to that. The URL is there. I won't spend any time on it here. Let's talk a little bit about the sensors. There are a number of sensors in the device. The first version of Windows Phone, Windows Phone 7.0, really only included the accelerometer, and you had full access to it. All of the phones that have been released include an accelerometer. Some of them in Mango have now also surfaced the compass, and many of them in Mango have added a gyroscope. And so you have access to all of these sensors, which is kind of handy. Gyroscope is really handy if you're doing, you know, image processing augmented reality and so on. And they all work pretty much the same way. They fire an event and they give you a reading. The problem with them is that it requires some really big brain mathematics to handle what's going on across all of these various sensors. And so what we've done is tried to make it a little bit easier for you. And actually, let's talk about the sensors first, and then I'll show you what I mean by that. The first thing you need to remember is that the sensors library is not added to your project automatically, so you have to remember to go and add it as a reference to your project, to your solution. And you should always check for sensor availability. Not all of the sensors will be available on all of the devices, and so you should definitely make sure anytime you're using a sensor, you should check the is-supported method to make sure that you actually have access to that. All of the phones will have an accelerometer, as I said. Those have been available and have been a requirement of any OEM building a Windows phone. They have to have an accelerometer. I mentioned that we had this capability of basically combining all of the various things that are coming back from all of the various sensors in a device. And the way we do that is with the combined motion sensor. And basically it takes the accelerometer and the compass and the gyroscope and gives you access to all of the various information coming back from that without you having to do all of that, you know, like I said, linear algebra and calculus and all of that crazy stuff to try and figure out what's going on. You basically will know the device orientation by managing the motion sensor. And the motion sensor will do some of that stuff for you. The problem is that it requires all of the sensors to be there. Not all of the sensors, but it certainly requires at least the compass to be there. So if you don't have a compass and accelerometer, then the motion sensor really can't do what it needs to, and so it won't be available. So there's various different types of data that's available depending on what the device is doing, and so you would have access to attitude, pitch, yaw, and roll, rotation rate, and direction of gravity. So you basically know the position of the device in three-dimensional space based on what is going on. And it will use whatever sensors are available, like I said, and it only works if the phone has a working compass. Not all phones have a compass. Most of them do. I would say 99% of them do, but some of them don't. And it's just an easier way. It just does all of the work for you. On other platforms, you have to do a lot of that work yourself. On Windows Phone, the motion sensor, which is really not a sensor. It's kind of a virtual sensor that combines all of the other sensors together so that you can do that. And this is how you would do it. You would create a motion sensor and bind that method. Basically, you tell it how often you want to know what's going on, and then bind to a method that gets triggered when those events are happening. And so anytime a current value has changed, that in this case, the motion underscore current value changed method will get called. And then you start the motion sensor, and then you make sure that you did actually start, because like I said, in some cases, it might, if you don't have all of the various capabilities, it might not actually start, and you'll want to know why. And then in this case, I'm checking for the yaw, pitch, and roll, but you can check all of the various capabilities that I mentioned earlier, and it's really a handful, and you can take advantage of all of those. And you basically check if motion data is valid, and it will actually tell you that using the isDataValid method. And then if it is, then you have access to that. And like I said, you can tell it how often, you know, how many milliseconds you need to know what's going on. Let's talk a little bit about video content. Every application can contain a media element that can play the video. In this case, we're defining a media element in XAML and defining the source as some source dot, or myvideo.wmv, which would be a local file. And then autoplay to true, which basically means when I load it, it will automatically start playing immediately. There are a number of codecs that are supported on the phone, and those are available online. You can do the same thing by pointing that same media element to a video that's out in the cloud somewhere. In this case, there's a Channel 9 video that I'm pulling down. And then again, it's doing an autoplay equal true, which basically means when I load that page, it will automatically try and download that video and start playing the stream of that video. And you can do some of this under program control. You can actually, if I have that media element, I can do media playback dot pause or dot play dot stop and so on. Oh, right, and here's where I'm doing it. So if I had a button on the screen that had a pause, and I click that, then I'm, by just using the media playback method, it just basically pauses that image. Windows Phone does also support smooth streaming, which is basically it's adaptive streaming where the software will detect the speed of your or how much bandwidth you have, and based on the amount of bandwidth you have, it will send either a higher quality or lower quality stream so that the end user never has to pause or wait for the video to catch up. And that's kind of handy, especially on devices, because you never know what kind of bandwidth you're going to have, whether you're on, you know, high-speed 3G or lower than that. There is some code that we've made available. It's open source up on CodePlex, and so you have full access to that. You would need the server side as well, where you would be defining all of the various stream qualities. And then there's some client code that's available for the viewing device for your applications. And I'm actually going to stop there. I actually thought I was going to go over today, but you guys didn't ask too many questions. So I'm going to stop there and say if there are any questions at this point, I'm more than happy to take them. Yes. Finally. Very brave.
Is the only way you can test the real augmented reality app with the thing that goes around? Or is there a way to kind of like proxy the webcam of the computer?
Ah, okay. Sure. So the question was, if I'm using an emulator, it's not really handy for me to see this moving text or moving square in the emulator, because that's just not handy for writing, in your case, an augmented reality application. Couldn't I just proxy the webcam and have that pumped into the device? There is no easy way to do that. There's no automatic way to do that. You could probably figure out a way to do that, but it's probably easier to just use a device. And if you're building augmented reality applications, you really should be using a device. For one thing, the emulator only has access to the accelerometer. There's no compass or gyroscope on the accelerometer. You just don't have access to it. You don't have access to the motion sensor. Like I said earlier, if you don't have access to a compass, you don't have access to the motion sensor. And you really should be using, if you're building augmented reality apps, you should be using the motion sensor. It's just so much easier, and we've done all of the hard work for you. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? This gentleman was brave in the front. I wish I'd brought a prize for him to reward him. All right, so if that's the case, then... they did ask me to show you that there are some resources available to you here in Belgium. Take a note of these, or you can grab them from my slides later. The slides will be available. There's a start page that they've defined. There's a link there to where you can get the SDK and all the various tools. There's a really good series of videos, which we call the Jumpstart videos, that you can use if you are just getting started as a developer. And then if you're ready to register as a developer so that you can do things like unlock a device and so you can actually publish applications into our marketplace, there's a link there to where you can go and register. Let me just say, leave you that my email address, benrieg@microsoft.com. I know all of you were so shy to ask questions that my inbox is going to be full when I get back to my desk, right? Please take a note of my email address, seriously, if you have any questions at any point. Anything that's going to help you get your application to the marketplace faster, I want to try and help you. And of course, follow me on Twitter, otherwise the puppy gets it. Yeah. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.